setting up such a nice conference and for inviting me and giving me the chance to tell you about something I've been thinking about for the last a couple of years. I mean, the motivation really for this is rather roundabout and something to do with the quantum brain, so I won't bore you with that. But what I will emphasize is entropy. You know, in classical systems, entropy always grows inexorably. In isolated quantum systems, there's some very deep connections between entanglement entropy and thermal entropy. And in quantum systems, unless you do something dramatic, entanglement entropy tends to grow. And entropy is a measure of essentially disorder. And so disorder always reigns, and that's the end of the story. You know, if that really was all that was going on in the world, we would just be moving into a state of maximum entropy. So I'm interested in how to control the spread of entanglement, how to control entropy growth. And there's one very nice way that I'm not going to mention, which is with quenched disorder in the context of many-body localization, where the disordered potential stops the spread of entanglement. I want to talk about another way to stop entanglement spreading is via measurements, making local measurements, which can tend to disentangle the entanglement that is inexorable in a unitary evolution. So in particular, I want to describe to you an interesting quantum dynamical out-of-equilibrium phase transition that we've been playing around with between an entangled phase and a disentangled phase driven by measurements. So just for background then, entropy, the thermal entropy counts the number of states, which is extensive at finite temperature, so the thermal entropy goes as a volume law. And consider the entanglement entropy for a given eigenstate up at finite energy density for some Hamiltonian, and consider a pure state density matrix, rho. If one looks at the reduced density matrix and calculates the von Neumann entropy, that's called the entanglement entropy for some region A with the rest of the system. And the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, among many of the things it says, is one is the equivalence of the thermal and entanglement entropy densities in the thermodynamic limit. So the entanglement entropy for a high energy density state is volume law. It's very entangled. There's very little local information. The information that was there initially in that state would be spread non-locally. And it's actually always been strange to me that the thermal entropy is a state counting. It just counts how many states you have in a given energy window. And the entanglement entropy is some property of the states. Nevertheless, they appear to be equal to one another. You can also look at, rather than an equilibrium system, systems that are out of equilibrium. So for example, if you take a one-dimensional quantum spin model, this is a Ising model in a longitudinal and transverse field, so it's not integrable. And you start in some initial unentangled state, maybe all the spins up, and then you quench and start running the dynamics with this Hamiltonian. The entanglement, which starts unentangled, spreads ballistically, even though the energy, which is conserved in this Hamiltonian, diffuses. And so this is a half-cut entanglement entropy, which is being shown to be growing ballistically with time. So entanglement just spreads. If one doesn't have energy conservation, and so there's nothing to stop the ultimate spread of entanglement, one can consider these models of just quantum circuit models with unitary dynamics, which then don't conserve energy. And you can consider a quantum circuit and involve a bunch of qubits, let's say with random unitary gates. It doesn't really matter whether they get random or not. But if you start with an initial unentangled product state, then the entanglement spreads ballistically. This is for the one particular instance shown from Adam Nahum's paper, and into a maximal entropy state. So in some sense, it goes to a completely random state at long times. Now, there's been a lot of focus about the initial growth of the operators coming from an unentangled state. But what I'm interested in is not that. I'm interested in the long time steady states. And in the long time steady states, if you just have unitary time evolution, it's boring. The state looks completely random. There's essentially no information, certainly no local information in that state. So how to control entanglement entropy growth? And I'm going to be talking about doing so via measurements. And the point about measurements is that they tend to disentangle. So imagine that I share with you a singlet, two spinner halves in a singlet. You have one part, remember, the singlet, and I have the other. They're very entangled. They're log two entangled. But if then I measure the z component of the spin of my singlet, of my spin, I find it up, and then yours is down. And after the measurement, we're in a direct product state. So we've disentangled. So making local measurements can disentangle the local degree of freedom from the other degrees of freedom. And it can lead to even non-local disentangling if you start with a very entangled state that you're making measurements on. So we're going to look at the competition between the entangling of unitary evolution and the disentangling due to measurements. And so we're going to consider a hybrid quantum circuit where, as I say, the unitary evolution induces entanglement growth and the measurements induce disentanglement. And we want to explore that competition between the unitary evolution and the measurements. And there's been a number of papers that have been looked at this really right at the same time. The work I'll describe is done in collaboration with a very talented grad student and postdoc in Santa Barbara and at the KITP, Yaodong Li and Xiao Chen. So in particular, we can consider at least initially, a precisely defined and special, if you will, a quantum circuit in which these are the qubits, this is time, and at periodic places in space-time, one puts two qubit unitary gates, and then in between these two qubit unitary gates, one makes projective measurements, let's say of the z component of the spin, and we're going to consider making the projective measurements, choosing to make a measurement with probability p, and to not make a measurement with probability 1 minus p. So for example, if p is equal to 0, we're making no measurements at all, and this initially unentangled state evolves into a very entangled state, in maximally entangled, and we get a volume law entanglement. On the other hand, in the opposite limit, when p is equal to 1, where we're making projective measurements on every qubit in every available time slice, that leads to complete disentanglement of the state after we make that row of measurements. And so we have essentially no entanglement when p is equal to 1, or maybe just a little bit of entanglement after we act with a row of unitaries. But in any case, the entanglement is, when p is equal to 1, is area law, not volume law. So the question of interest is what happens in between p of 0, p equals 1, when we make a finite rate of making these measurements. There's sort of three possibilities, really. One is that the volume law phase survives all the way to until we make measurements everywhere. The other is that the area law phase kicks in, survives everywhere until we don't make any measurements at all. But most interesting, and what we seem to find, is that there's a critical value of the measurement rate where there's a phase transition. An entangled phase separates a disentangled phase in this phase transition. So I want to describe some of the basically numerics we've done on these hybrid quantum circuits where we can pull out an enormous amount of information about this phase transition and its how generic it actually is. So
when you make the measurement, you randomly choose one of the outcomes?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. We randomly choose one of the outcomes, and then we're following what are called the quantum trajectories. So if you have a state and you measure the spin, if it's up, that's this state. If it's down, it's this state. We just pick one and follow that. And then we fork again and we follow that. So we consider...
Pick it with the probability that it should be picked.
Exactly. Pick it with the probability that it should be picked based on the Born rule.
You have to know the full wave function, the full many body system, right?
Well, you'd think you would, but you can... It turns out that there's... using Clifford technology, which I'll now describe, you can evolve, calculate the long time limit of things like the entanglement entropy without keeping track explicitly of all of the components of the many body wave function.
I'm just asking how the simulation is done.
I'm telling you how the simulation is. If you do it the straightforward way is what you're saying, you keep track of the wave function at every time slice and you work out the probability, the expectation value. of SZ on one site, and then you flip a biased coin to choose whether it's spin up or spin down, and then take the pure state that you find, maybe it's spin up, right, and then follow that.
Right.
And that's very different than looking at the density matrix and summing over the measurement outcomes, in which case the density matrix would become mixed. You could do that. You could follow a mixed state density matrix. And what you find then is that it evolves to a infinite temperature density matrix. You get no information whatsoever. So all the interesting information that we're going to be looking at is in the nature of the pure states of these pure state quantum trajectories, and the phase transition is in the properties of the pure states. And it's a bit like many-body localization where the canonical density matrix trace e to the minus beta h doesn't have any information about the transition, but the eigenstates themselves, the wave functions, show a volume law or area law behavior depending on which side of the many-body localization transition you're on. So this is really similar to that. We're looking at a wave function in the nature of the wave functions. And these are, I think, often called quantum trajectories, because we're in the many worlds view, we're just living in one world. And we have a pure state in that world always. So many worlds people would like that, I think.
How do you choose your two Cubitian theories?
Well, OK, in different ways. So I'll describe that. I mean, we have a bunch of choices you can make.
Magic.
Yeah.
So this. Do the answers depend on which branch you're living in?
Well, we average over the different branches, or we average over time, or we average over circuit runs. And it doesn't matter. If you look, most quantities self-average very nicely. Yeah, particularly the entropy does.
Do you average over the probability you take the outcome?
Well, we average over the probability that we take the outcome, because we run it, let's say, through, and we end up with some wave function, and then we calculate something like the entanglement of that, and then we run it again. But we end up with a different wave function, take the entanglement of that, do it again. All those wave functions are statistically the same. And things like the entanglement entropy will be, at least when you take large subsystems, will be the same for each of those states. I mean, there'll be some small fluctuations, and you average them. You could look at moments, but it self-averages nicely, at least entanglement entropy does.
Are you starting with a particular state?
Yeah, it doesn't matter what state we start with, because what we're interested in is the long-time steady state. So we're going to run it for a long time. So we take a finite system size and run it, for arbitrary, very, very long times until it's fully, I don't want to say equilibrated, but it's reached a steady state. So we can start with a direct product state. We can start with some random state. And where you end up doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter the initial state.
Because the depth of the circuit will depend on that. So I'm thinking if you start with a maximally entangled state, it might take a long time before it goes.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, how long it will take to get into the steady state can depend on the initial state. Yeah, that's right. We haven't really focused so much on the initial entanglement of a direct product state as we've been focusing on the long-time steady states. All right, well, yeah. So, straightforward and direct numerical simulation is challenging for large L, since the Hilbert space grows as size 2 to the L, so it's hard to store a wave function with 30 qubits. So what we've primarily done is employed this quantum information technology of stabilizers and code words, evolving with Clifford unitaries. And I'll just describe it very quickly. Some of you probably know this really well. And for me, this was, I didn't know it at all. I had to learn it. Let me describe that. But basically, if you consider special circuits with Clifford unitaries, the Gottesman-Knill theorem, and this is Dan Gottesman here, says that such quantum circuits can be efficiently simulated on a classical computer, so we'll be able to access the quantum dynamics, non-equilibrium quantum dynamics of like 500 qubits, right? So it's, stabilizers are Pauli string operators, so let me just, a quick notation, Pauli operators I'm going to write with x, y, and z in the quantum information notation. So Pauli string operators for L qubits are just literally a string of Pauli operators. The first site is the identity, then y, x, identity x, and so forth. And stabilizers, code word states, are special states which are, quote, stabilized by L-independent commuting Pauli string operators. So you have L qubits, and you find L-independent commuting Pauli string operators, which I'm calling G sub j. And I'm defining the code word state, which is one which is an eigenvector with eigenvalue 1 of all of those stabilizers. So just as an example, let's say we take the state which is all the qubits are equal to 0. That's stabilized by Pauli string operators with length 1. So just z1, z2, z3, and so forth. Another example, if you take a Bell pair state just for 2 qubits, 0, 0, plus 1, 1. It's 2 qubits, so we need 2 commuting stabilizers to stabilize that state. And those you can choose as z1, z2, and x1, x2. And you can verify that this Bell state is an eigenvalue 1 eigenvector of these 2 stabilizers. And the reason it's nice to, Clifford unitaries is a Clifford unitary. When you conjugate one of these Pauli string operators, it takes it into another Pauli string operator. So that's what's very special about Clifford unitaries. A more general unitary will take a Pauli string into linear combinations of many Pauli string operators, and the operator will get very complicated. Here you go from a single Pauli string to a single Pauli string. And so you can look at the unitary evolution of the code word state. Rather than looking at the state directly, you can follow the dynamics of the stabilizers. So if psi is stabilized by a set of stabilizers G sub j, then unitarily evolved psi prime is stabilized by G prime. Okay, and it's quick to work out how these stabilizers evolve under these Clifford unitary dynamics. You can also make projective measurements within this stabilizer formalism. So if I can consider a projective measurement of a code word, so here's a state stabilized by a code word state stabilized by stabilizer G sub J, and let's say I measure the Z component of the jth qubit, where the state's going to be modified by this projector. So imagine that Z sub J anti-commutes with the first stabilizer G1 and commutes with all of the other ones. For example, you can always multiply the stabilizers together to make that the case, at least one of them to be anti-commuting. Then the stabilizers are modified under the measurement as the G1 stabilizer is replaced by the measurement Pauli string, which is, since the single qubit measurement is just one, like, excuse me, length 1, so Z sub J. So you can implement projective measurements. And then you can say, well, how do you get out physical quantities? Well, there's a number of things you can compute.
The previous slide. So my question was precisely in the very last step, how do you choose do you choose plus and minus the equal probability, or?
Well, actually, it turns out, you can work it out. You use the Born rule and you compute it.
There's some tricks to that.
Yeah, it's only 2 or 3 lines, but you definitely compute it. We compute it, or my student computes it. My student does it all. I just chair and try to follow what's going on. So let's see if I can follow. See if you can follow my following. It's the bane of an aging physicist. Let me tell you guys, all you young guys in the audience, just don't get old. Or if you get old like Subir. No cognitive decline whatsoever. It's okay, Subir. You take compliments well. So But this is kind of cool. This, so one way that you can calculate entropy, entanglement entropy, directly from the stabilizers, and this is kind of intuitive, so I just wanted to convey it. So, so you can define a stabilizer length. So here's 10 qubits. The first two qubits are the identity and the ninth intensive identity. And so the length of this stabilizer is length 6. It goes from the first non-trivial qubit Pauli operator to the last non-trivial Pauli operator. And so now consider your one-dimensional set of qubits and your region A divided from region B and C, and you want to get the entanglement entropy S sub A. Well, you look at basically all of the stabilizers which have one end in A and one in B. Let me call that N sub B, the number of the, such stabilizers. And then you define N sub C, the number of stabilizers that have one end in B, one end in A and one end in C, excuse me. You sum those together, N plus N C, and you divide by 2, and you multiply by log 2, and that's the entanglement entropy. So, you know, we know that, like, if you have two spins entangled in a singlet, you know, if you make a cut and put one in region A and one in region B, you have log 2 entanglement. You have log 2 entanglement per singlet. Well, here you have log 2 over 2 entanglement whenever you cut a stabilizer with your measurement, with your bipartition cut, I guess. And it works that it's 1/2 here. So I go back to this case here. So aside with the Bell pair, the two qubits, one of them is entangled with the other one with a log 2. And you would have to, that both stabilizers start at the first qubit and end at the second qubit. So that would be 1/2 plus 1/2 log 2.
That's
right. Yeah.
So a very dumb question. So there's the idea here that the state is defined by the stabilizer.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why just operate with the stabilizers.
Yeah, so you start with a nice simple state, for example, all zeros. And then, yeah, so if you have L stabilizers that commute, they uniquely define the state. And so you find the ones that uniquely define that state, which is a Z, Z1, Z2, Z3. And then you start evolving with Clifford unitaries and you follow the stabilizers. Each of those stabilizers starts growing in length. And they spread out, and they get kind of complicated. And there's gauge freedoms that you can always take two stabilizers and multiply them together to make, you know, replace the first one by the, you know, G1 times G2. And so, in fact, what I was saying here about the entanglement entropy is, in a particular gauge where every site has two stabilizers are coming out of that site, which you can always do. So it was called by Adam and Sagar, a clipped gauge. So it's in that special clipped gauge that you have this very simple interpretation of the stabilizer the entanglement entropy in terms of stabilizers, just by looking at their length.
Are we guaranteed that these sort of Clifford circuits reproduce the same statistics as like a random unitary circuit?
No, we're not guaranteed. Yeah, but you get volume law entanglement. The wave functions, I mean, the code word wave functions, what's special about them is that if you look at the wave function, which in general is a complex number, right, and you move the particles around, if you have a wave function of a set of particles, and that, you know, the wave function phase keeps changing around as you move the particles around. So in a Clifford, in a code word state, the wave function phase takes on just 4 values, 1, I, minus 1, minus I. So it's like the wave function space itself has been, you know, cut down and, you know, sort of in some sense quantized. So it's still got the sign structure, sort of the notion of the random sign structures you can have. So that's where you can have very entangled states. But there are, you know, some aspects of it, of these Clifford circuits, which are non-generic. And in particular, this operator spreading, I mean, a single operator just stays simple. Pauli string operator stays as a Pauli string operator. So there's definitely certain things about them which are special about these Clifford circuits. Anyway, let me describe the results. So Clifford circuits, the nice thing about them is they're simulable. And so the first set of results I'll show you is for the two qubit unitaries taken randomly from the Clifford group. And the single qubits are taken from the Pauli group, just measuring the Z component of spin. The measurements are made with probability P. You simulate Clifford quantum circuits. I should say the one as a side, the Clifford circuits, all of the Rennie entropies are equal. And so when I said the entanglement entropy was given by the number of stabilizers that cross the cut, that's true for any Rennie index of those entanglement entropies. So then we basically, my student runs this circuit in long times and computes, I think here is the, a bipartition into 1/4 and 3/4, calculates the entanglement entropy and averages over time or over runs through the system. But it self-averages very nicely, the entanglement entropy. And what's shown here is a bunch of curves. The curves up here are for very low measurement probability. And on a log-log plot, their slope approaches 1, which is volume law entanglement. But the coefficient of the volume law is going down, as you can see. This is increasing measurement rate. When the measurement rate is bigger than some critical value, then the entanglement entropy doesn't grow with system size, with subsystem size either. And then you get in a region which is area law entanglement. And then there's apparently or seemingly a transition between these two. We have evidence for it. I'll show you a little bit more evidence now shortly for a generic phase diagram in which there's an entangled phase with volume law entanglement for low measurement frequency, a disentangled phase where the wave functions become area law entangled, these quantum trajectories become area law entangled for high measurement frequencies or frequent measurements. And then there's a critical value P sub C. And there's various critical properties, which I will briefly describe about this disentanglement or entanglement transition. But let me first show a very nice way to identify where the transition is. It's a little hard to tell where the transition exactly is here, although you can see it's the one in black, right? So but the way we identify that is we look at the mutual information. So here's the one-dimensional spin chain with periodic boundary conditions divided in A and B, which have lengths L over 8. And we look at the mutual information SA plus SB minus S union B. And basically, the mutual information, one can argue, and we find it numerically, that both in the volume law phase and in the area law phase, as L gets big, the mutual information goes to zero. Basically, if we're in the area law phase, the entanglement is decaying exponentially. So things are not very entangled. So it's not surprising that distant parties, Alice and Bob, cannot share any information because there's no things disentangle before correlations reach one another. In the volume law entangled phase, Alice and Bob's quantum degrees of freedom are very strongly entangled with all other degrees of freedom, and that kind of swamps out the mutual information that's stored between Alice and Bob. But right at the critical point of this transition, somehow it's a sweet spot where you can share some quantum information, and in this particular geometry with A and B having size which grows as some fraction of L, in this case L over 8, the entanglement entropy as you make the mutual information, as you make the system bigger, gets sharper and sharper. And right at the transition, it approaches some constant value, presumably some universal constant value. We can do a data collapse, and pull out correlation length exponent nu, which is around 1.4. Once we've identified where the transition is, it's where this peak is, we can go back and draw in this black line, and we can look at the entanglement entropy of that sitting right at PC, and it's consistent with a logarithm. So the entanglement entropy grows as log of the subsystem size with some coefficient alpha sub C, which in a conformal field theory, this would be C over 3, the center charge divided by 3. We find alpha C reproducibly about 1.6, in many different circuits that we look at. And once you see this logarithm at the transition, there's a natural scaling collapse you can do for all of the data for the entanglement entropy. You know, so you can take all of this data and do a data collapse. It's sort of conventional scaling, but not quite. What you really want to do is subtract off this logarithmic piece and look at SA of P minus SA of PC. And then that should be some scaling function of LA divided by a correlation length. And the data collapse works pretty well with a correlation length given by roughly the same as it was when we scale the mutual information. We can look at other things at right at the critical point. We can look to see whether there's signs of conformal symmetry. So we sit at P equals PC, and we consider two regions A and B with endpoints x1, x2, x3, x4. If there is some underlying conformal field theory, then the mutual information should depend only on the cross ratio, x1 to x3, 4, divided by x1 through x2, 4. And so what's shown here is a bunch of data taken varying the size and locations of the regions A and B, and all of the data essentially falls on one line when plotted versus this cross ratio. So this, you know, it's at least consistent with having some underlying conformal field theory, not the, we can try to look at correlation functions, and here, well, because, I mean, eventually, we would like to imagine that some of this stuff could be experimentally, you know, looked at, right? And it's very hard to measure this thing called atoms or any system, the entanglement entropies, directly. But correlation functions, you would think, should be perhaps measurable. So the mutual information is an upper bound for all correlation functions. But so the correlation function, the way we compute these correlation functions, is for a different, for a given pure state. We, for example, calculate the connected piece of the correlation function, basically just taking an expectation value of these two operators in that pure state. We then square that, and then we average over the ensemble of pure states. So it's worth emphasizing that this cannot be written as trace rho O for any operator O. If it could, rho is actually infinite temperature, so there would be no correlations whatsoever. So we're doing this, you know, averaging in a bit different way than one would normally, you know, think about doing in a statistical ensemble. We're making this square, which is crucial. And so what's shown here is this squared averaged correlation function for basically Pauli, for ZZ correlation function. I mean, it's integrated over some region A and B. And that correlation function, it's a little noisy, but it has peaks at the critical value of PC, and those peaks get smaller. So what we believe is that the correlation function like this is similar to the mutual information in that it decays, well, it would decay exponentially in either phase, in the volume law entangle phase with the area law entangle phase, and decays as a Powell law at the critical point. And I should say, you know, having a correlation function decay as a Powell law at a critical point is only possible in a non-equilibrium system, or in a many-body localized system, it can be. So that's really not, I mean, that's, you know, equilibrium system mechanics is broken down there. Here, the system is non-equilibrium because we're making these measurements and running with these unitaries. There's a kind of a remarkable hidden logarithm inside the volume law phase. So what do I mean by that? Well, I want to argue, and we can see how to argue for that, is that the entanglement entropy in the two phases, one, it goes as a volume law. That's for the low measurement rate frequency phase. It's the logarithm at the critical point, and then there's a it goes through a finite area law at the in the area law phase at high measurement rate, but there's a background log L to this linear L volume law, which would not be there in an eigenstate of some Hamiltonian upper high energy density. If you look at the wave functions, their volume law in L sub A with order one corrections, and You might say, how on earth can we pull out a logarithm background from a linear L, even if we're looking at systems of size 500? Well, the way we do that is rather indirectly. We look at these stabilizers, and we look at their length distribution function. So these are, this is x is the length of the stabilizers, d is the distribution function. And we're plotting on a log-log plot, and you see these straight lines here. Those have slopes 1 over x squared. And then you see this peak, and this peak are stabilizers which have length L over 2. And it's these peaks which have stabilizers length L over 2 which contribute to the volume law, a piece of the wave of the entanglement entropy. And it's these, this Pau law distributed 1 over x squared part of the distribution which gives you the background logarithm. This is increasing measurement rate. And here you're sitting right at the critical point. Now you only have the Pau law. And then when you're on the area law side, then you it basically becomes exponentially decaying. So you can.
Excuse me. What do you mean by stabilizer links? I mean, if I multiply two stabilizers, it's another stabilizer.
Yeah, so it's in this clipped gauge. You have to choose a special gauge where there are two stabilizer ends on every site. Right. Yeah, that's good. Question, thanks. Well, so the stabilizer length distribution function, it goes as 1 over x squared. And then this sort of essentially a delta function at L over 2. These are the long stabilizers, which give you the volume law and the Pau law. But basically, we then just integrate up the stabilizer length distribution on this plot here. And give us this behavior that I already mentioned. So we have this interesting log background. And I should emphasize that this logarithmic background, what happens is you approach the transition, the entanglement transition from the volume law phase, is that the coefficient of the volume law just disappears smoothly, and this logarithm gets exposed. So the logarithm that's there at the critical point is there somehow living inside the volume law phase, which is kind of curious, I think. Yeah.
So the mutual information is zero in the area law phase, right?
Yeah.
In the volume law phase.
Both.
Right. But somehow is this compatible with this log L correction to the entanglement entropy?
Oh, I see, because you're worrying, like, if you have a Pau law distribution of these stabilizers, you know, why doesn't that give mutual information? Because they reach across. Yeah, that's what we thought that might happen, but it turns out that this equivalence between the how many stabilizers you cut to and the entanglement entropy only works for a contiguous region. If you're region A separated from region B, you can't get the entanglement entropy in the same way. And so you have to, but we had thought it might be, you know, you get Pau laws and the mutual information in the volume law phase because of that background log, like you're suggesting. So now we also have looked at other circuits with, these are still Clifford, but we're now with different types of translational symmetry. So what's shown here is a Floquet set of unitaries, C0, right, left, and then putting the local Z measurements in randomly. And then we get, the data looks the same, all the exponents look the same. We consider a circuit with, you know, periodically placed measurements, or really quasi-periodically placed measurements. And here these are two unitary gates are random. Okay, so we still get the same critical properties, transition, same critical properties. The locations of the transition are different, of course. And then we consider a Floquet in the unitaries with periodic measurements. So then there's no randomness in this circuit other than the measurement outcomes themselves, right? But nevertheless, even though the data is noisier, we get the same properties of the transition. So the transitions don't depend on whether it's translationally symmetric or not, whether there's disorder in the unitaries or in the placement of the measurements. That doesn't seem to be important. We've also done some simulations of, you know, beyond Clifford on Haar random unitaries. Now here's, you know, more, you know, we can only do up to system sizes of 20 because one's really following the wave function now and all the components of the wave function. So in a very nice paper by Skinner, Aum, and Nahum, They argued that in this case with random Haar two-qubit unitaries and random single-qubit measurements, that if you look at the zeroth Reni entropy, it corresponds to, you can map it to first passage percolation on a square lattice in which the percolation critical point corresponds to the entanglement disentanglement transition, and it occurs at 1/2. What they show numerically is for the, though for the nth Reni entropy, there seems to be a different transition and possibly different transition. It's only a one different transition where PC is less than 1/2. And you know, what we show here is mutual information that we calculated varying the Reni index n. And in the inset, one shows the mutual information for the Reni index n going to equals a 0. And there's a transition, you know, which is presumably percolation, right at PC is 1/2. But for n, Reni index of 1, 2, and infinity, there's a peak near 0.2, so near some 0.25, you know, some critical point. So the, I mean, we think there's actually a unique phase transition for the, all these other Reni entropies, and that the zeroth Reni entropy is somehow very special. And you can see that the zeroth Reni entropy is very special by considering making, rather than projective measurements, we can make generalized measurements. So these are the type of measurements you get, or you can get if you couple each qubit to an ancilla with some particular coupling and some unitary coupling, and then you make a measurement of the ancilla. And then you get effectively a generalized measurement. But we basically just define measurement operators with a lambda there. Where lambda is 0, there's no measurement made. Lambda is 1, it's a projective measurement. And lambda is a parameter which we can tune, just like p was a parameter we tune when we make these projective measurements. The nice thing is we can now take, we can make weak measurements on every qubit at every time step. So we can make it uniform. And there's no randomness in the measurement positions now. And what we find is that the Reni entropies, excuse me, the mutual informations with Reni index of 1 to an infinity show a peak, but the mutual information with zero Reni index has no transition at all. It's in the volume law phase all the way up to lambda critical is equal to 1. And that's different than when we make projective measurements, the zeroth mutual information has a peak and a transition at 1/2. So somehow the zeroth Reni entropy is very special.
This is all for qubit circuits?
This is all for what?
Local qubits.
Local qubits.
Do you think?
What do you mean local qubits?
Well, no. At each site you have a qubit, right?
Yeah, it's just a qubit. Is that what you mean? Not a qubit or something?
Yeah. So I was going to ask, do you think PC would depend on the local dimension?
Yeah, PC is non-universal and will depend on everything, pretty much.
No, but it doesn't depend on the system size.
No, it doesn't depend on the system size. It's the location of a transition.
Those are like the only two parameters in the problem, like the system size and the local dimension.
Yeah, I mean, which unitaries we choose, and you know.
Can you calculate PC as an analytic function of Q, at least for like the random circuits, like Haar random circuits?
I can't, but maybe you can. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there may be things one can do analytically. I was talking with Ehud about that, and there's other people who've been trying, and I think some progress can be made, but we haven't been really exploring that so much. So, I just have a few minutes. This is a case where we have Floquet, which is basically an Ising model, ZZ, XX, ZZ, X, and Z, you know, three rows of unitaries. And then weak projective measurements. So then there's no disorder whatsoever, except the measurement outcomes. And here, the mutual information has a nice peak for the Reni entropies with mutual information with Reni index 1 to an infinity. But for n equals 0, there's no transition. So might this be measurable, some of these things? Well, cold atoms, Rydberg atoms, ions. I mean, there's certainly, you know, quantum computers in superconducting qubits. There's lots of, you know, small, you know, quantum computers or atomic systems where one can make local unitaries and make, you know, make single qubit measurements, in fact. And so, you know, one might imagine some sort of comb geometry This is just one example of a situation where in the cold atoms, maybe bosons are hopping on this comb geometry. One can make projective measurements let me call this the system and this the environment or ancillas. One can make projective measurements on the ancillas if one turns off these the hoppings. And then one could, you know, run the system some more and then make projective measurements, run the system some more and run through this circuit. And then at the end, you're trying to measure the average squared number fluctuation correlation function in regions A and B. You know, something like this, delta NA, delta NB, connected part squared, averaged. You know, we can run the simulations in this case, and I won't describe the details, but it's just basically just taking here an Ising model written in a Floquet representation. Oh, no, I'm sorry, it's an XXZ model. Sorry, so it's for bosons. This is XY model with a Z interaction, and then there's an this is the coupling between the environment and system is a boson hopping. So this is really measuring with discrete time the bosons hopping on a comb lattice, and then making projective measurements of the boson number on the tips of the comb. An accessible transition, we see a peak in the mutual information. We see a peak in this correlation function. But I just want to finish with something we're thinking and getting very confused about, which is even though in principle one should be able to access this transition, I mean, here's 20 qubits with you know, small, you know, measuring A and B are just size 1 and separating them by distance 10, and one sees a peak, which is a signature, indirect signature of this transition. So in principle, you might be able to measure it, but in practice, what you have to do is you run the quantum circuit and you get, making projective measurements, run the quantum circuit, and you get some pure state, we assume. And then you have to try to work out the expectation value of the fluctuation in the number operators. But normally when we work out expectation values in quantum mechanics, we assume that, or if we want to do it experimentally, we assume we can prepare the same state many times. You know, otherwise you just get a one-shot measurement. If you just do a one-shot measurement, you don't get full information about this expectation value. But in this quantum circuit where you're making measurements and you're preparing the state by making unitaries and measurements, it's impossible, near impossible, to prepare the exact same quantum state more than once, right? So making multiple copies of each pure state will be very hard. Now, what I'm hoping is that even though, so you have this a given state and you can make a one-shot measurement, and I'm hoping we can somehow exploit the self-averaging. So you can imagine, you know, you're measuring, this is the one-dimensional system, you measure it over here, ZZ, 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 and average, and do like a spatial averaging rather than a averaging over many measurements of a given wave function. Now, is that going to be the same thing? I don't know. We'll you know, we're doing some numerics to see. But so it's kind of, it's up in the air in my current understanding whether or not this is even in, you know, is going to be accessible in experiments. I certainly hope it eventually will be. So let me just look at the open-end future. Well, there's this question of the genericity of the Clifford transition with these Cliffords. We don't really know. To the extent that we can pull out any exponents, and we really can get only one exponent in the case where we have hard random, and that exponent agrees with the Clifford exponent. But in the Clifford, we can get many more exponents. But we don't know. People have been trying. Ehud was describing, you know, his work towards getting an access to the transition analytically, which I think is exciting. You can look at transitions in high dimensions. We've done Clifford in D greater than 1, and there's a transition. It's not surprising. I don't know anything about duality. Well, I know something about duality in field theory, nothing in gravity. But I do know the buzzwords, black hole, information paradox. I know if you're, you know, it's like in a black hole, is information missing? You know, why don't you do measurements to try to see, you know, get that information to see whether it's missing or not? So, you know, the question, if you have a black hole, an ADS CFD black hole, and you start making projective measurements in the field theory, what happens to the black hole? Everyone I've asked, the string theorists, they say they don't know, or that it would heat it up, you know. But if you're looking at pure states, you know, there's something going to be happening. And presumably, and you know, the field theory has some non-trivial correlations. You can tune it to some conformal field theory by making the right number of measurements. So can you then shrink the black hole somehow? This background logarithm in the volume of state suggests that if there is a black hole picture, that the black hole would have some structure in it. It wouldn't just be an entirely random state, you know, like a thermal state. And then the experimental access, which, you know, is, I think, also, you know, up in the air. So anyway, thanks. Sorry I went over a bit.
For one quick question. When you made the knowledge to, like, this 2D CF disentanglement entropy relation, like, so do you have some interpretation of this state as some CFT?
Well, it's...
Or is it just analogy?
I mean, it's largely an analogy. I mean, there are these mappings or people making mappings to spin models. And then the entanglement entropy is something to do with the free energy of a segment of length A, the free energy in space-time, basically, of an interface between two states, or let's say an Ising-ordered case. So, you know, we know in these, you know, approximate mappings, or maybe eventually exact mappings to spin models, you know, which correlation functions that we are extracting in that mapping. So, you know, the correlation functions of interfacial free energies and boundary changing operators. So it's, you know, they're slightly different correlation functions than they would be in straight in the conformal field. They're in some sense, some cases related to them. But so it's, this is a vague answer to a good question. And it's because I don't really understand.
Yeah, let's thank Matthew again.